You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
Those of you who have been enjoying our reposts of Catherine Barnard's series will be pleased to hear that she has now brought out a third episode on the Brexit process. Here she talks to Bonnie Soanes about the draft EU withdrawal agreement. Why is it important? And is it indeed what this country wants?
Well, yes and no. It's what the UK more or less signed up to. If you remember, there was a joint report in December, 8th of December last year. We had a podcast on this and what was in it. And this is the legal manifestation of it. This is turning what was essentially a political agreement into a legal document. And what a legal document it is. It runs to 118 pages, 168 articles, two protocols. There's a lot of meat in here. The EU has been doing its homework. And it's pretty striking that the EU's been doing its homework and doing the drafting. The UK has been giving speeches. And as we know, we've had lots of speeches, culminating last week in Theresa May's speech on the future. But the withdrawal agreement is the Article 50. It's the divorce. It's the terms of the divorce and also the terms of the transition, which eventually will bridge over to what a future agreement might look like.
So we've had both the publication of the EU withdrawal agreement and Theresa May's speech. How do they relate to one another? And what's the next marker that's going to be put down in these negotiations on Brexit?
So the withdrawal agreement is essentially about the past. It's about the divorce. It's sorting out the money. It's sorting about out what you do to EU citizens who are currently in the UK. And it's also about sorting out the Northern Ireland border. Theresa May's speech is looking forward and looking to what the future relationship might be. Now, we know that in reality, any negotiations about the future relationship aren't going to take place in earnest until after we've left. However, the EU has said that alongside the withdrawal agreement, that's the divorce under Article 50, there'll be political guidelines, political declaration, outlining the potential shape of that future relationship. And that's what Theresa May is speaking to, what those political guidelines might be. The next big step is the March European Council, where they'll start looking at what those political guidelines might be. And that's what we want more than anything else, because we want to be able to say that we have got agreement on what our future deep, close, special partnership might be. And we want to have that in place before we leave on the 29th of March 2019.
And then we will know whether we've got the cherries we wanted on our cake.
At least we'll know whether we've got some of the cherries that we want. And devil, of course, is always in the detail. And that won't come out until after we've left in 2019.
So we've got to wait until after we leave to see the detail.
Absolutely, because the real detail of the negotiations won't start until after we've left, because the EU says they can't do a trade deal with a member state. You've got to wait until you've left the EU to do a trade deal. Now, if there was goodwill on both sides, as the UK has argued in the past, we should be able to do the divorce and the future trade deal at the same time. EU's not having any of it. They say the detailed negotiations won't happen until after we leave. And that's a problem for the UK because, of course, we'll have lost our leverage. The leverage we have at the moment is over the money, the $50 billion exit bill that we're going to have to pay to settle up our liabilities. But we're trying to use that as leverage at the moment. And that's why there's quite a lot of talk both about the past, the withdrawal agreement, the Article 50 agreement, and the future. That's what Theresa May is talking about.
Well, one more analogy with a cake. So we might see the cake with the cherry on top and added cream in Fitzbillie's cake shop, but it might well come to the situation where when we withdraw, we can't claim that cake. We can't afford to buy it because we haven't got the right agreement or our ducks aren't quite in a row.
Yes, absolutely. There's wonderful metaphors that you can engage in here, but that's absolutely right. We want to have our cake and eat it, but of course, having our cake, whatever form it might take, may well come with a price tag attached. Theresa May has conceded that already. The question is, are we going to be prepared to pay the price tag? And how far do we want to go in terms of staying close to the EU, but with limitations on our sovereignty, but with the economic benefits? Or do we stay further away from the EU, lower cost, but clearly some significant cost, economic hardship as well?
Now, you said it was 118 pages long. It's clearly taken Eurocrats some time to delve into what a Brexit agreement with the UK could look like. Do you think Theresa May's speech rejected that agreement, or that we are still working to some of the issues outlined in it?
So Theresa May's speech is very much about the future, what we are going to get once we have left the European Union. And of course, there's still an element of cakeism about it, special, deep, close partnership, whereas the EU is saying, well, you've got the choice of either Canada or Norway. But what the withdrawal agreement's about is dealing with the divorce, the separation issues, tying up the loose ends, tying up the divorce payments, tying up what's going to happen to the children, the citizens. All of that's in the withdrawal agreement.
All right, well, let's look at one issue, the transition period. What does the agreement say about that?
So transition period is incorporated into the withdrawal agreement, legally actually quite important, because it was never clear whether there was legal competence or legal power to have a transition agreement. It's being wrapped up with the withdrawal agreement being done under Article 50. Now, what's striking about it is two things. One, it's basically status quo transition. So the UK will carry on in the single market and the customs union, but without having any say in policy formation, so won't be involved in the EU institutions, the Commission, the Council, and crucially the Court of Justice.
Let's just take one of those, perhaps. What about the Court of Justice? What happens to UK law during this transition period?
Yeah, we're going to be subject to the full force of the jurisdiction of the Court of Justice. That's the court that sits in Luxembourg. But it's not something of an oddity, because while you can understand that the UK won't be involved in policy formation, so drafting of new directives which will bind in the future, the UK will still be subject to rulings of the Court of Justice, and as things stand at the moment, without any British judge on the Court of Justice. Now, this does feel somewhat peculiar, because it's a foreign court adjudicating on the UK system. I think there's a good argument for the fact that British judges should stay on the Court of Justice at least to the end of transition, because the European Court of Justice will be adjudicating directly on litigation between parties in the United Kingdom, enforcement actions in the United Kingdom, and surely we want a British judge to be able to have a say in some of those cases.
So we will, as journalists put it, be a rule taker, not a rule maker. And those rules will apply to trade, where you might get much conflict and challenging of the rules.
Exactly, and we might also say the rule of law dictates that there should be judges from the countries which have an interest in these cases, and the fact that there won't be a British judge involved in deciding these cases feels very uncomfortable, and certainly would appear to play into Eurosceptic hands to say, why should we be listening to adjudications by that court when there's no British involvement at all?
Okay, so that's one area where Theresa May might be right to question the EU withdrawal agreement as published. But let's take another area, citizens' rights. Theresa May has said that EU citizens can have residency rights in the UK while the transition is ongoing.
Yep, absolutely. Now, Theresa May actually made a rather quiet but important concession, slipped out on the 28th of February, the day that the EU published this rather large text on the draft withdrawal agreement. And she said, she conceded that actually EU citizens will enjoy the same rights that they do at the moment, even during the transition period. Now, there was an argument that she had tried running for some weeks, which had some sort of method in it, that said, well, for those EU citizens arriving before the 29th of March 2019, they had a legitimate expectation that they would enjoy the benefits of EU rules. Those arriving after the 29th of March 2019 during the transition period knew we were leaving, so therefore they shouldn't be able to have exactly the same protection as those arriving before we left. However, the EU has made clear they weren't having any of that. That's what appears in the withdrawal agreement. It looks like Theresa May has conceded that point. And from a practical point of view, it makes a lot of sense because, of course, it's already going to be difficult for the Home Office to get systems up in place to try and register all the 3 million EU citizens here. If you've got to have essentially three systems, one for EU citizens arriving before the 29th of March 2019, another system for those arriving after the 29th of March 2019, and a third system for non-EU nationals, all of that takes a hell of a lot of organisation. We haven't got the time to do it.
If you take a classic Remainer Brexit debate, the Brexiteers will argue that the EU is making it all too complex, including a border in Northern Ireland. We know what Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary, has said regarding the Northern Ireland border and comparing it to borders in London and electronic equipment. But if you look in the EU withdrawal agreement at the 168 substantive articles, do you think the agreement is a fair one?
Well, the EU would say they're giving effect in legal terms to the agreement which was entered into by Theresa May in December. And of course, I would say that in respect to Northern Ireland, the most tricky issue was paragraph 49 of the joint report. And paragraph 49 offered three options. Option A, which was essentially the UK, Ireland coming up with some sort of deal for Northern Ireland. Option B was technology would sort out the issues of the Northern Ireland border. And option C was essentially staying in the single market customs union, at least for Northern Ireland and the South. Now, option C was always seen as the default. However, in this withdrawal agreement, option C has become the rule and not the default. Now, a bit further down the text is buried reference to the fact that if at a future date the UK comes up with some sort of alternative arrangement, then option C gets replaced. But at the moment, option C is the rule.
If you were a member of the EU, if you were Barnier heading the negotiations, would you trust the UK, given what's happened and the setting out of the UK stall and then perhaps the backtracking to appease the 60-odd hardline Brexiteers? Is there an issue of trust between the UK government and the EU now?
I think there is an element of trust. We know that just after the political agreement in December that David Davis went on the Andrew Marr programme and made some fairly disobliging remarks about the agreement, indicating we might back away from it, the EU got worried. And you can see an element of that in the withdrawal agreement because it does say that if during transition the UK doesn't play ball, there's the possibility of going to the Court of Justice. Court of Justice can impose a lump sum or penalty payment on the UK. And there's also provision in the agreement for suspending parts of the agreement itself if either side doesn't play ball. So I do think there's a concern about trust. And of course, the EU reads the British press and they take it very much at face value. So they know what's going on and they are concerned.
Now, if you look at some of the subject headings within the agreement, you've got supervision, interpretation, enforcement and sanctions. How controversial are the enforcement and supervision elements of the EU withdrawal agreement?
Yeah, this is what's new. So what you've got in the withdrawal agreement, for most of the agreement, but not the part on citizens' rights, for most of the agreement, what you've got is, first of all, the establishment of a so-called joint committee, which is going to be comprised of representatives of the UK and EU. No detail given about how many, how they're selected or anything like that. Joint committee does the legwork. If there's a problem, then the joint committee can issue a recommendation. If the joint committee is not sure, the joint committee can ask the Court of Justice. So there is still a role for the Court of Justice on the interpretation of the withdrawal agreement. And if the joint committee take too long at getting their act together and coming up with a solution, then either the EU or the UK can ask the Court of Justice to intervene. And if the Court of Justice gives a ruling but either side doesn't comply with it, then the other side can go back to the Court of Justice that can impose sanctions. So what we're seeing in this withdrawal agreement is Court of Justice is not dead in the water, and that reiterates my point. Not only should we be thinking about having a British judge during transition, because we will be bound by EU law, but isn't there an argument that there ought to be a British judge having some say while the Court of Justice has any jurisdiction over us?
You said that that argument plays into the Brexiteers who think we're being treated unfairly by the EU. Can you venture a judgment on that? Is the EU being too harsh on the UK for wanting to Brexit?
Well, the EU has, I think, done some cut and paste from the EEA agreement, the European Economic Area Agreement, and that agreement's the agreement that's doing a Norway by shorthand. So the establishment of a joint committee and the possibility of the Court of Justice being involved is already in the EEA agreement. Now, of course, this is only a draft agreement. The EU has put things in it that they know that they might have to negotiate away, but a lot of it is reflecting what the EU-UK agreed in December. And of course the EU has got the first mover advantage because the EU has drafted the text, and it's always easier to work from a draft of a text, and it tends to favour the person who drafted the text.
Theresa May's speech, do you think the scribes in Europe will be quickly amending the various clauses and all of the 118 pages to take account of what can be called cakeism, Theresa May's desire that she won't have an agreement that's like Norway or Canada or even Switzerland that took years to draw up, but that the UK is going to have its own bespoke trade agreement sector by sector with the EU. Do you think they're redrafting it?
They certainly won't be redrafting the withdrawal agreement, because the withdrawal agreement is only about the divorce. It's not about the future arrangement. So there might be some renegotiation going on over the content of the withdrawal agreement. One thing to note in there, for example, is that for UK citizens who've been living in the EU for a period of time, they've got the right to stay in the state that they're living, but they've got no rights of onward free movement. Will the UK want to negotiate that on behalf of UK citizens who are living abroad? The UK says there's nothing to stop a Polish national from leaving the UK and going on to France, but under the agreement, British national living in Spain can only stay in Spain and not move on to France, Germany afterwards under the terms of the withdrawal agreement. And for a lot of people living abroad at the moment, that is deeply unacceptable. And that's one of the issues that's being raised in the case being brought by Jolyon Maughan at the moment.
If you were to look at the whole negotiating period, people accuse the UK of wasting time. As you said, we've only got about a year to go before we Brexit, and business doesn't know where it stands and what the rules of engagement will be, whether you're in agriculture or manufacturing or fisheries. But isn't this just what happens in negotiations? It's about who blinks first.
Sure. And the EU has a long and well-known history of negotiations going right up to the line, and it's only with the pressure of a real deadline does something serious happen. And we can anticipate that may well be the case in respect of looking to see what the political guidelines are, which is all that we can hope to get on what the future trade deal would look like before we leave the European Union. So yes, absolutely, these things are done at the 11th hour. On the other hand, because Brexit is so complex, and this withdrawal agreement gives you a taste of just how complex it is, the EU needs time to prepare, the UK needs time to prepare. And I think one of the things that's really striking about Theresa May's speech last week is that she said clearly, we need transition, we need a time for both sides to prepare. What she didn't say was how long that time should be. She said it needed to be time limited, but she didn't say 2 years. And the reality is it's going to take far more than 2 years, not to mention the 20 months that the EU is currently given, to actually start preparing for our new future trading relationship.
We have peace between both camps now, who seem to be content rather than overjoyed by Theresa May's speech. So we've got the Brexiteers and the Remainers remaining quiet for a few days. But do you think that perhaps that peace will break when we see negotiations continue and see what the UK eventually signs up to? Because there is this element of cakeism in demanding a bespoke agreement.
Absolutely. And of course, in respect to the future, We hear from Theresa May that she wants to stay close. She wants to stay in some of the big EU agencies. She wants to participate in some form in Euratom, the European Atomic Energy Organization. So she's trying to stay close. And for the first time, she's even mentioned something about free movement of persons in the future agreement. So there is some energy to go forward to stay close, but of course that's not what the Brexiteers want, and the risk is that she falls foul of both sides, that it's not hard enough for the hard Brexiteers and it's not soft enough for the soft Remainers.
Even odds on a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit?
I think what will happen is we will get, the withdrawal agreement will be concluded. I think there'll be transition. Transition will take longer than people at the moment think. I suspect it may need to be at least 4 or 5 years, not the 2 that are currently being talked about. And then beyond that, it's very difficult to be able to predict. I suspect it will be softer than some of the hardest Brexiteers want, but not as close as the soft Remainers want.
Which goes back to your European Court of Justice and challenging to that agreement and the trade deals that are done. Perhaps deal by deal might be up for challenging.
Absolutely, and Theresa May does allude to that in her speech, that the Court of Justice will have a role which extends way beyond us leaving the EU, way beyond the 29th of March 2019.
Which is going to enrage the Brexiteers even more. But let's just go back on that word cakeism. Is the UK government cherry-picking what it wants from the EU without signing up to those important 4 freedoms?
Inevitably they are, but as Theresa May herself said, all free trade agreements involve a degree of cherry picking. The thing is, what we're asking for is not just small cherries, but very big ones, and with quite a lot of cream on top.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.